For a scripture reading this morning, I have a short quiz for you. As I read 2 Samuel 11 this morning, let us keep in mind the relationships of these three men to David. Eliam, the father of Bathsheba, and his son-in-law Uriah were in the list of David's 37 mighty men. Ahithophel was David's most trusted advisor, even before Jehoiada and Abiathar the priests, and he was also the grandfather of Bathsheba. Just like we know who Gus, Nathan, and Pastor Ike are, David would have known these men even more intimately over a period of many years. They trusted each other with their very lives as they fled Saul in the wilderness, and as they fought many battles alongside David when he was king. When David was told who Bathsheba was, he knew exactly who her family was, and yet he still pursued his wicked ambitions. After Bathsheba told David of her pregnancy, David had good reason to be afraid of the consequences of his actions. Please follow along as I read 2 Samuel 11. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her, and when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, and said, "I am pregnant." Then David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people and the state of war. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. Now when they told David, saying, "Uriah did not go down to his house," David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Stay here today also, and tomorrow I will let you go." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now David called him, and he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his bed with his lord's servants, but he did not go down to his house. Now in the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. He had written in the letter saying, "Place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him, so that he may be struck down and die." So it was, as Joab kept watch on the city, that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. The men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war. He charged the messenger, saying, "When you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, 'Why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? Why did you go so near to the wall?' Then you shall say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'" So the messenger departed and came and reported to David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, "The men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archer shot at your servants from the wall, so some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead." Then David said to the messenger, "Thus shall you say to Joab, 'Do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him.'" Now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, She mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife. And then she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord.
Solomon tells us in the book of Ecclesiastes that there is nothing new under the sun. The account that you just heard read by Olin could have come out of yesterday's police report. The details might have looked a little different, but the desires and sinful choices are exactly the same. Let me show you. I've taken the first five verses of 2 Samuel 11 and put them in our current culture. David is just a normal, everyday guy. Give it a listen. Verse 1. One spring, at the peak of busy season, David decides to take some time off to relax and refresh while the rest of his coworkers and family members are scrambling to get everything done. He hiked to a cabin to spend a night alone to recharge his batteries. Verse 2. Now when evening came, David pulled out his smartphone to check social media and check on the news. As he scrolled through the different feeds, he saw a picture of a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful in appearance. Verse 3. So he clicked on the link, just to check on the price of the tub, of course, and a warning popped up. You are leaving Fox News. Are you sure you want to proceed to xyz.com? Verse 4. David clicked yes, left that website, and entered the forbidden website where he began to indulge his eyes, committing adultery in his heart. After masturbating, he cleaned himself up, deleted the browsing history on his phone, and went to bed to catch a couple hours of sleep. Verse 5. A couple days later, David is sitting at the table with his wife, reading an email they received from their pastor, when a new email pops up from the website he had visited the other evening with the subject line, "Are you ready to see some more?" And that is a mild modern-day version. It could be worse yet and closer to what we see here in the text, what David is doing. But I trust you understand that if you have access to a smartphone or a computer, what I just described could have happened to you if it has not already. I'm told that now in the United States, the average age that a young person sees pornography for the first time is only 8 or 9 years old. That's the average. That means that we have kids younger than that seeing it. I pray that's not true for anyone in this church, but I trust you understand that it is a reality. The world we are living in is consumed by sex. What used to just be sold in the shady parts of town and come into your mailbox in nondescript packages is now free and available for anyone to see. Companies know sex sells. So commercials and advertisements specifically use women dressed in sexually alluring clothing to draw customers in. Our culture is obsessed with sex. 21 years ago, I am sitting in a cabin with other sixth grade boys at Outdoor Ed. We're in the cabin, sitting on our bunk, sitting on the floor with our two counselors, a junior and senior high schooler. Our counselors want us to go around the room and have every one of us share who we either want to kiss or have sex with. I was 12 years old. 21 years ago, it hasn't gotten any better. Sex is out there, and the world is calling us to drink and indulge deeply, promising we will be the happier if we do. So what does God say about all of this? For some Christians, unfortunately, the most that they have heard on this subject from a pastor is, sex outside of marriage is bad. Don't do it or you will be a very bad sinner. Thankfully, that is not what you have been hearing from this pulpit, right? Pastor Ike and Pastor Dell preached through the book of Song of Solomon a number of years ago, and as we come to this topic, we've mentioned it since then as well. This morning, as we come to 2 Samuel chapter 11, God provides us another opportunity to review and see what God has to say about sex, to counter the narrative that is currently being pushed by our world. And so in order to do that this morning, I want us to first look at God's design and purpose for the sex drive. Then I want us to consider an example of what it looks like when that sex drive is out of control, as demonstrated by David. And then we're going to close this morning by discussing practically what a God-honoring sex drive looks like. So as we dive into this important topic, it's vital to establish from the very beginning that our sex drive comes from God. It is a God-given sex drive. Sex is not the result of the fall. On day 6 of creation week, when God created Adam and Eve and brought them together as husband and wife, he specifically instructed them to come together as one flesh. Genesis 2:24, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Part of that one flesh union is physical intimacy. Based on what we see in chapter 1, where we're told that they are to be fruitful and multiply, we know this is part of God's creation. And when we connect this with what we see in Genesis 1:31, God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. That included the sex drive which he had given to Adam and Eve. The God-given sex drive is good. Genesis 2:25 makes the observation that both Adam and Eve were naked and they were not ashamed. Because of sin, nakedness is shameful. But even after the fall, in marriage, God has designed nakedness to have no shame because husband and wife accept one another for who they are. They love and are committed to one another. In reality, the God-given sex drive encourages marriage. This is one of the reasons why we refer to it as sexual intimacy. You see, sex is given to us by God for the married couple in order to draw them together, to deepen the intimacy, to deepen the connection, to know one another. It's so interesting that it's the same Hebrew word that we looked at last week in Psalm 1:6. Remember yada, where God knows us, he has chosen us? That's the same Hebrew word that God uses throughout the Old Testament to refer to the sexual union and marriage between a husband and wife. Genesis 4:1 is just one of many examples. And so we see here that the connection and love that a husband have for one another is partly expressed through their physical union. Sex has the great potential of drawing a husband and wife together. That's one of its God-designed purposes, to encourage marriage. Now, we also understand that sex also has the potential to drive a husband and wife apart when it becomes a very selfish act, but that's another topic for another day. Sex is intended by God in marriage for mutual pleasure, designed to further and deepen the oneness in marriage. The God-given sex drive strengthens the marriage bond. But that's not all. God also has given us the sex drive for procreation, to bring forth children. Our culture has, by and large, almost completely separated sex from one of its main God-given purposes, which is to bring forth children. This is one of the main reasons why abortion is embraced by our culture to the extent that it is, even though people know that that is the murder of innocent children. You see, the God-given sex drive is good because it strengthens and encourages marriage and it brings image bearers into this world. But it's important to keep in mind that the God-given sex drive doesn't ultimately fulfill. Jesus Christ is better than sex. Do you believe that? You know, as a single person, I struggle with that if I'm honest. There were times when I didn't want Jesus to come back until after I was married. But now, as a married man, while sex really is great, I've come to understand what I should have known all along, that sex doesn't ultimately fulfill. In fact, whether you are married or single, I believe that God has given us a sex drive as a reminder of our deeper need to be known and fulfilled by God. As Sam Alberry writes, "Sexual unfulfillment itself becomes a means of deepening our sense of the fuller, deeper satisfaction we await in Jesus. It helps us to hunger for him." And I agree. The sex drive is good, given to us by God. But just like eating and sleeping, it can quickly get out of control. If we allow our desire to eat to drive us, we will become a glutton. If we allow our desire to sleep to control us, we will become a sluggard. Just like we need to depend on God's Spirit to control our eating and sleeping, God calls on us to depend on Him to control our sex drive, even in marriage. If not, we will have a gone haywire sex drive. That's what we see here in 2 Samuel chapter 11 with David. And as we look at David's example, I want us to see what happens when we exclusively allow our sex drives to lead and guide us, when our sex drives become out of control. David provides for us a vivid example of what James explains in James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, the path into sin which leads into death. Notice first, it begins with the warning lights. As we begin chapter 11, we are immediately informed that David, pretty likely that he was being lazy. As you can see in verse 1, when he should have been going out to battle, like all kings do, he stayed home. When he should have at least been working on some of the many administrative tasks that kings do, he was lying in bed. Notice, the text tells us in verse number 1 that he got out of bed when evening came. You see, it's possible that David had laid down for an afternoon siesta and he was too lazy to get back out of bed. Why else would he be getting out of bed when evening came? I think David is being controlled by his emotions and feelings, which is an extremely dangerous place to be. Well, instead of getting a little work done before retiring for the night, David decides to take a stroll on the roof. I don't think there was anything wrong with David doing that. That was his roof. That's what roofs were designed for back then. Remember, this is a flat roof that probably had a wall around it, similar to the picture you see on the screen. But as David walked on his roof that night, he saw a woman bathing. And that at that exact moment, the warning lights, the warning bells, the warning alarm should have been going off in his head. He was being tempted. He needed to close his eyes. He needed to bounce his eyes. He needed to get out of there. But he doesn't. Keep in mind, being tempted is not a sin. We sin when we enter into that temptation, when we give into that temptation. Also, keep in mind that the fact that David is tempted here is very instructive for us. Because I'm sure you've heard, maybe you've thought yourself, that people sometimes think, if I just had a more attractive wife, I wouldn't be so tempted. Or if my husband was just more understanding and compassionate, I wouldn't be tempted. But David has at least 7 wives at this point and probably a number of concubines. And even though David has an overabundance of opportunities for pleasure, he was still tempted to want more. Our sex drives are never satisfied when we step outside of God's design. Let me say that again. Our sex drives are never satisfied when we step outside of God's design. Instead, they just continue to grow and become more and more out of control. David has already violated God's boundaries for the sex drive by taking multiple wives and concubines, and he's still not satisfied. And so today, swimsuit additions do not satisfy. They only lead to harder porn, which leads to more evil. Unfortunately, David chose to ignore the warning lights. And as a result, if you will, he stepped onto the waxed slide into sin. And this is where we're going to see James 1, 14 to 15 played out in David's life. You know, once a person steps onto this waxed slide of temptation, it's almost impossible to get off before you've fallen into the sin. And that's exactly what happens to David here. Notice first, in verse 2, he lusted. As I mentioned, when David's eyes caught Bathsheba bathing, he should have quickly turned away and went back inside. Instead, he lusted. He continued to look in such a way that he discovered that she was a very beautiful in appearance. Jesus has informed us that David was sinning at that point. He says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, "But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." But that wasn't enough for David. David continues to slide down this wax slide into sin by inquiring. Did you see that in verse 3? David's questions here in verse 3 are not purely motivated. Instead, he's asking these questions to figure out if he can have her. But I believe as he gets the answers, really this is God's mercy, right? God is providing a way of escape with these answers, a way of escape that God always provides to you and I when we are tempted. But unfortunately, David doesn't observe it, doesn't take it. You see, when David's servants come back with the information that this woman is married and that her husband and her father are mighty men in his army, that should have brought David to his senses. That news was his way of escape. Those facts should have warned David that he was on the wrong path. The path he was pursuing was not wise. He should have got off the slide into temptation. He should have escaped. But David was being controlled by his uncontrolled sex drive. He was being driven. You know, verse 3 should have read this way. So just like Joseph, David immediately averted his eyes, went back in his house to pray and sing praise to God. After he realigned his heart with God, he sought out his wife and spent time with her. But that's not what happened. Instead, just like Ephesians 5:3 informs us, David's sinful drives were being motivated by greed. He wanted more. You see, now there's a new lady who is beautiful, and because of his greed, he feels like he must have her. And so he seeks her out. In verse 4, David sends messengers to Bathsheba's house for the sole reason of bringing her to him. He intentionally sought her out for the purpose of stepping further into sin. This is just like clicking on the link that promises new pictures or picking up the latest book that promises the most steamy and romantic scenes that will thrill the mind or choosing to watch the show that you know has content that you should not see. At that point, it's almost impossible to stop. You've started down the path. You're on that wax slide which leads into sin. A short time later, David's messengers return with Bathsheba, and the text tells us that when she came to him, he lay with her. David violated Bathsheba. And even worse, he was sinning against God. By having sex with Bathsheba, he was committing a sin that carried the death penalty under the Mosaic law. David's sin was extremely serious. David experienced a short time of pleasure that night, but was it worth it? Sin can be pleasurable in the moment, but the after effects are terrible. Sometimes the question is asked, why is sex outside of marriage such a bad thing? How is it any worse than any other sin? Well, there are reasons, there are many reasons why sex outside of marriage is wrong. God, through the pen of the Apostle Paul, gives us one of them in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 18, where we read, "Flee immorality. Every sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body." There's something about immorality that is uniquely harmful and damaging to a person. I mean, if you think about it, sex outside of marriage treats the other person as a product to be consumed instead of a spouse to be loved and to connect with on a deeper level. Sex outside of marriage really cheapens a person. And that's one of many reasons why this whole idea of living together before marriage is simply foolish. After you have sex with someone who is not your spouse, what do? An act which is designed by God to bring a husband and wife together can actually drive a man and a woman further apart, as we're going to see when we get to chapter 13. But here in chapter 11, there seems to be this drawing together of David and Bathsheba, but there's nothing they can do about it because she is already married. And so the only other option in David's mind is to attempt to cover up his sin in the hopes that certain people won't discover it. If you will, the wishful cover-up. Likely that very night, if not the very next morning, David sends Bathsheba back to her house. David is acting just like the adulterous woman that we read about in Proverbs 30, verse 20. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, "I have done no wrong." And that's how David is processing his sin. He's acting as if he has done nothing wrong, attempting to cover it up. And for weeks, David thinks he is good to go. But then, Bathsheba discovers she is pregnant, and she immediately informs David. As Warren Wiersbe has said, you can interpret her short message to David there in verse 5 as this: the next step is yours. Well, by God's grace, they did not choose abortion, an option which is often chosen today. But the choice David made wasn't much better. In fact, it was just as bad. David immediately sends for Bathsheba's husband, Uriah. As Uriah comes into his presence, David praises Uriah for all the hard work that he has been doing fighting in the army, telling him that he's going to give him a short vacation. David's hoping that he will go home and lie with his wife. But Uriah is a man of integrity. He refuses to go home while the rest of the army is fighting, while the Ark of the Lord is in the field. And so when that doesn't work, David tries to get Uriah drunk. But as one man said, a drunk Uriah was acting with more wisdom and integrity than a sober David. And so when that plan failed, David decided that he would have to just kill Uriah. It was so sad to see how low David had to go in order to cover his sin. Did you see that in verses 14 through 15? As he's sending Uriah's own death notice in his own hand as it goes back to Joab. Joab carries out the orders, and as a result, Uriah and other men needlessly die. Blood is on David's hands. Well, Bathsheba receives the news of her husband's death and mourns for him there, as you see in verse 26. After the period of mourning, David sends for Bathsheba and takes her to be his wife. Months later, a baby is born to Bathsheba and David. And for those who don't know, it was a very large baby to be born so early. But David wishfully thought that he had covered up his sin, that he had escaped any consequences, that he was good to go. But as we see here in verse 27, the Lord was not pleased because David's actions were evil. They were wicked. A person cannot engage in this type of sin and escape all consequences. I mean, just looking at the physical level to begin with, STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, are on the rise. The latest statistic I got off of the CDC's website this week was that there were 26 million new cases. 2018 was the date for that. And that's just in the United States alone. And over half of those 26 million were young people, ages 15 to 24. But not only that, the way sexual sin affects the mind, the brain, is so sad. Research has been done that definitively shows that pornography changes a person's brain. The way they think, the way they process life, let alone the way they interact and treat other people, which is another huge issue. But the biggest issue is how sexual sin affects our spiritual lives. If you've ever watched Ray Comfort doing some of his interviews on YouTube, as he's sharing the gospel with people, at times he will ask them when the last time was that they viewed porn. And sometimes they'll come out and say it was just yesterday. Other times they might be a little bit more sneaky. But if the person admits that it was recently, sometimes he will say, that's the reason why you don't want to turn to the Lord. And I think he's right. But even believers struggle with porn, men and women alike. This is not just a man's issue. Porn, just like all sins, drives a wedge in our relationship with God. It's building a wall, harming our fellowship with our God. If you're engaged in this or any type of sexual sin, you're going to be in bondage to that sin. You will be miserable, as David attests in Psalm 32, 3 and 4. You cannot cover it up. Instead, it's going to eat you up from the inside out. And so if this describes you today, I want you to know this morning that there is hope. No matter what your specific struggle is, Jesus Christ is able to set you free. Jesus is more powerful than any sin, any enslaving action that you find yourself in this morning. Jesus can set you free. God longs to extend his grace and mercy to you, to draw you back to himself. Heath Lambert has written an outstanding book entitled Finally Free. We have extra copies here at the building, and I'd love to get a copy into your hands this morning before you leave. There is hope. You can be set free. But if you continue to look at porn, read romance novels, or dabble with anything in this realm, it's going to negatively affect your relationships with others, specifically with your spouse, and most importantly, with God. As we will see next week, God does forgive, but there are real everyday consequences that you will have to live with because of your decision to step outside of God's design for the sex drive that he gave to you. This is why you and I must understand what a God-honoring sex drive looks like. A God-honoring sex drive, simply put, is controlled by and under the direction of God. God's word has given us very specific instructions about how God calls us to honor him with our sex drives. Notice first that it is to be enjoyed in marriage. God designed the sex drive to be enjoyed in the bond of marriage. When it is under the protection of the covenant of marriage, it is a beautiful covenant reaffirming act that brings the husband and wife closer together, as we see in Proverbs chapter 5, as well as in the Song of Solomon. And the great thing about a God-honoring sex drive in marriage is that it never gets old. It never gets boring. Yes, the tendency is definitely there for that to happen. But if the focus is on pleasing your spouse, drawing together in intimacy, it is always good. One of my favorite verses that I don't often share is Proverbs 5:19. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. But notice this last phrase. Be exhilarated or be intoxicated always with her love. Always. Always. It shouldn't stop. It might look different as the years go by and your bodies change, but the intimacy a husband and a wife share should never get old and boring. Research has been done in the last number of years that backs up what God has been saying all along, that the most happy and sexually fulfilled people are married people who are committed to one another. The world and Hollywood tries to portray that it's much more satisfying, much more fulfilling to be free and do whatever feels right to you, but they are lying. They are liars. Do not believe them. God designed the sex drive exclusively for married couples. God is the creator of the sex drive, and God is the one who has set forth the rules and boundaries. Remember, sex is a very intimate act designed by God to be reserved for and practiced in the safety of the covenant of marriage. And when that happens, it is a very beautiful and satisfying and fulfilling act. Any sexual act outside of the covenant of marriage is unfulfilling and empty in the end. Hebrews 13:4 is crystal clear. Marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. I really like how Eugene Peterson paraphrases this verse in the Message as he writes, "Honor marriage and guard the sacredness of sexual intimacy between wife and husband. God draws a firm line against casual and illicit sex." But what about the single and unmarried person? If we know that the sex drive is to be exclusively enjoyed in marriage by a husband and wife, how should a single person respond to their God-given sex drive? Well, the answer, which is true really of all believers, whether you're married or not, is this. The God-given sex drive is entrusted to God. Let me explain. We often wonder what the will of God is, when the reality is the will of God is very plain in God's word. One of those places is 1 Thessalonians 4:3, where we read, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that is, that you abstain from sexual immorality." Now, that's not new to most of us. Most of us are familiar with it. But the question still remains, why then does God give an unmarried person a sex drive if they have to abstain until they are married? As a single person, it can seem frustrating that God gives us this desire, but then calls us not to do anything with it until we get married. It's almost like giving a child an ice cream cone on a hot summer day and then telling them not to lick it. But the reality is, God is a good father. God is not torturing you. Instead, he has given you a sex drive as a single, as an unmarried person, for at least two reasons. We're just going to look at two. First, he wants you to get married. Now, I understand that's not true for all singles. God calls some people to be single for life, and that is a good thing. That is a high calling. But for the vast majority of singles, this is true. And so, guys, when you find a Christian young lady, ask her to marry you. Get married. Young ladies, when a godly young man comes along and proposes to you, accept. All right, get married. It's a good thing. But as you wait for marriage, keep in mind, your sex drive is not a bad thing that you need to be ashamed about. As one wise mother told her daughter, "Jesus isn't afraid, surprised, or even offended by your desires. But he expects you to deal with them the same way you deal with everything else in the truth of his word." And those are wise words, which lead right into the second reason why God has given you a sex drive as an unmarried person, which is this: because he loves you and desires for you to turn to him. I really like how one author put it as she wrote, "God created sex, then told us to enjoy it only within the context of marriage between a man and a woman. So, if he has us wait an excruciating long time for it, he is mercifully teaching us to meet our deepest desires in him alone." That's good. As she goes on to say, that's easy to say, right? It's incredibly hard to live. But that's how we need to process this. We must use our sex drives as another reminder of our desperate need to depend on God. We must continue to throw ourselves on the mercy and grace of God. We must seek to walk in his strength, because it's impossible to walk in our own strength in this area. We must put on our spiritual armor. We must remember what we read in Psalm 16:2. "I said to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good besides you." You see, our sex drives remind us that we have a deeper, more important need to be known by God, to be satisfied in God alone. We are reminded that God is good and everything that he does for us is good. This same thought process needs to be true of married people as well. Even as a married person, we must entrust our sex drives to God. As David demonstrates for us, marriage is not the sole solution for an uncontrolled sex drive. If you think that marriage is going to fix your problem, you are wrong. It's only when God is working in your heart, causing the fruit of self-control to grow and develop, that we will be able to honor God with our sex drive. It's only in God that we're able to have victory, the victory that he calls us to walk in. Well, I've just barely scratched the surface of this very important topic. There's so much more that can and maybe should have been said. So if you have questions or additional thoughts, please come and talk with me. Talk to one another, elders. Talk to a mature believer. But keep in mind, freedom is available in Jesus Christ. We have an incredible God who is gracious and merciful, ready and willing to forgive and restore you in ways that only he can. And so if you have made mistakes in this area, it's not too late to receive God's forgiveness, to depend on God's strength and grace to live a pure life before him. An uncontrolled sex drive cannot be conquered in your own strength. You cannot do this alone. You need God's strength. You need God's resources. And one of the resources that he has given us is one another, our fellow believers. You need to tell someone. And so children, talk to your parents. Men, reach out to another man. Women, reach out to another woman. Let's be willing to be open and honest with one another for the purpose of honoring and glorifying God in each and every aspect of our lives, including our sex drives.